Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Wendy Kiefover-Ring about cougars, and she is from Wild Earth Guardians, and the situation of cougars here in the state of New Mexico. And we're also going to be talking to the good folks from the Meow Wolf Gallery. Right now, I would like to welcome the Furies. We have Hollis Walker, curator, and artists Mary Bennett and Beverly Ash, and they are part of the exhibition which is taking place Art Santa Fe, which opens tomorrow night. That's Thursday night from 5 to 8 at El Museo Cultural. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Hi.
Now, why do you call yourselves the Furies?
Well, this was sort of Beverly's idea. Beverly and Mary had decided they wanted to do an exhibit at Art Santa Fe, and they called me up and asked me would I be interested in curating it. And we had a big discussion, ultimately deciding that it should be an all-woman show. And in trying to come up with a concept for this, Beverly had been reading something that had to do with the Furies. The Furies being the Roman name for the same goddesses that appear in Greek mythology, called the Erinyes. And they're the Avengers of Justice, the three goddesses who sort of wreak havoc in the lives of ordinary mortals who do wrong, especially if they do something like, oh, kill your mother, and the Furies are going to be after you forever. And,
or tell a lie.
Or tell a lie, that's right. Mm-hmm. Do things that, violate the moral conscience of good people.
So you guys are basically the moral police of Santa Fe?
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. Perhaps we should be being policed, but we certainly do have enough outrage to, share it should there be the need.
And so we never lie.
And that is one of my favorite lies. I never lie. Because nobody can say that, and virtually nobody can say that and mean it.
Yeah. Right.
So how did you come together? It's not just the three of you. It's some other artists, a number of other artists as well. How did you come together? Did you, Hollis, the curator, bring this group of furious ladies together?
Well, it was Beverly's idea to call them Furies. And the two, Mary and Beverly, really had decided they wanted to do some kind of exhibit at Art Santa Fe. And then, got me involved. And then the three of us sort of started talking about it. And really the construct is that in many ways women artists still have a more difficult time getting their work shown, especially if their work is weird, scary, confrontational, not fitting into the normal, that's what girls are supposed to make sort of mode.
Which is what?
Well, I think it's an ill-defined thing, but I think that that women still have a heart. Mary, pick up here. You can say this better than I can.
my take on it is that old nursery rhyme about sugar and spice and everything nice, that's what little girls are made of. Well,
that can't still be operative in the art world.
Oh, please. Where have you been? It's not only operative.
Oh, come on. We have Eve Ensler.
We have everybody, and you're going to see eight of these at Art Santa Fe tomorrow. You're going to see eight difficult women who do difficult work. And that's the premise of this show. The work is gorgeous, beautiful, interesting,
sweet,
provocative, no sugar and spice in any of it. So we're hoping that you're all going to come, and I know you are, Mary Charlotte, and see what's going on.
So let's talk about some of the actual work that you're doing. Do you want to, Beverly, how do you talk about your work? There's a lot of swan imagery.
Yes. I started this. It's a series that I'm doing called The Art of War, and I began using images of black eyes as a motif. This was a series about conflict. And as I started doing all these brutal paintings with black eyes, I started to want to lighten up a little bit, so I found swans have black eyes, and I started to look into swans. And then I found all these beautiful images on the web and videos that people had taken. Case in point, there was a wedding where there was a bride who was leaning down to feed one of the swans, and it sort of nipped at her, and she jumped a little bit, and then it just turned into a full-scale attack where it was ripping her dress off. And I just loved that image of conflict and all the things that a swan represents, which are often very romantic images, but yet it becomes a very fierce creature when it's defending its territory.
Swans are tough in real life.
They can be, yeah. But I think people still have this misconception, like they're cute and they're pretty and the ducklings are pretty. And
like girls.
Yeah, exactly. So they get into a lot of unbeknownst or unforeseen conflicts with them.
And so that sort of entered your work as... I mean, there's mythological Leda and the Swan kind of precedence for it. Are you working with that kind of thing?
Yes. I think I just became really captivated by the image of how beautiful and graceful that they are and as a motif, and how brutal they can be when they're... And I think the whole idea of this series was about sort of coming full face with the idea of conflict. There's a lot of war going on in the world and a lot of other things. So I really wanted to face that and really examine that. So there are other images that I'm using, sort of dogs that are used as interrogators and that kind of thing. So it's the swans are kind of a lighter touch in terms of the series.
And what about, I have to say, the pink bunnies.
Also had black eyes, you know.
I saw this painting of the pink bunnies from a distance, and I went, oh my God, she's gone over the edge. She's painting pink bunnies. And then you get up close and they've got those black eyes, and it's about quite a different thing.
I think it's about kind of going into some really dark places and then also trying to pull back and lighten up just a little bit. You know, it's about that. I mean, I think some of these situations are certainly absurd, like with the swans, but there's this kind of beauty to them too. And I think that's what a lot of conflict is about, is that kind of, there are so many facets of it, you know, including beauty. I think that's part of our world. And
Mary Bennett, let's talk about your work. You have, among other things, would you call it a sculpture or an installation with a lot of handkerchiefs?
I do.
Now that's femme.
Very. And these handkerchiefs are all 40 and 50 and 60 years old. They're the kind that your grandmother always tucked up her sleeve. They're beautiful. I had no idea that they were, but I've collected them for years. And I have silkscreened these all to read, "He Lied."
He Lied.
He Lied.
He being?
He could be anybody. He could be, it's a towering, what do I want to call, a cascade of Kleenex, in essence. And they all fall in a waterfall to the ground. But he could be your first boyfriend. He could be a boss. He could be George Bush. You could be Tears for Your Country. It's just an example of nobody, I don't think any woman can look at it and not think of someone who has lied to her. I doubt that any guy can look at it and not think of someone he's lied to. So it's one of my feminist
or
statements.
Or who's lied to him.
Or has lied to him, absolutely.
Yes, the next one will be called She Lied.
it's hardly gender specific, although I chose not to make it He Lied, She Lied. I chose specifically to make it He Lied.
Yeah, that might be just a bit much.
Yes, but it goes along with my knitted noose. So I have a hangman's noose that's made out of knitting. Which represents how women sort of put themselves in a position that they can't get out of. And
enslaved by domesticity sometimes.
Yeah, on occasion.
Okay, but that's kind of 50s, and the reaction to it is kind of 80s.
Actually, I think it's probably time for it to come full circle again. Those of us who lived it the first time need to remind those of you who are your age that you need to watch out for the people 10 years younger than you are, because they've never had to fight again. And things are, times are tough. The economy's tough. The world is tough. The war is on. And it's time to remember that this needs to be part of who we are all the time.
I mean, it seems like it's a privilege to be a slave of domesticity these days, because everybody's working multiple jobs.
So it seems.
Yes and no, but the studies continue to show that even in married couples, even where men do take up some of the household or domestic chores or child-rearing chores, et cetera, that women are still working like 30% more than men in terms of they're working a full-time job and they're coming home and taking care of the children and doing all the cooking and doing that, you know. So a lot of the supposed advances of feminism of my generation didn't get quite as far as they might have. And in times of war, it's been historically shown over and over and over again that there's a regression in cultural attitudes and that women always bear the brunt of that, you know. So I'm kind of with Mary on this. I think it's just as valid as it ever was to talk about these kinds of issues.
And I think this is a discussion that we had with each other, because I remember when the first idea came up to do this show with all women, my response was, oh my God, we're still being separatist, no men. You know? And this was like a discussion that we had about, and really so many things haven't changed. You know, it seems like so many things have paved the way for, you know, younger generations, but there's still the guerrilla girls functioning, for example, full swing. I mean, they still have many, many things to protest about. And I think that's what's interesting, is not assuming that it's all kind of fixed and, you know, it's still going on. And it's not about really, I think, becoming separatist or complaining or whatever. It's just an awareness that we all need to have.
But when you look at the work of these eight women and you see what's shown, it's full of humor and full of pathos and full of pathos, right, Hollis?
Either way you want to say it,
whatever way I want to say it.
Nice to have an editor with you.
It's got, it's just, I think people will be charmed.
Well, I wanted to say a couple things about some of these other artists, if you don't mind. Stacy Brown is one of the artists in this show. Stacy doesn't currently show at a gallery in Santa Fe. Some people may not be familiar with her work. She's an extraordinary realist painter. Just extraordinary. The works that we are showing in Furies of hers are not portraiture, which she often does and very well. Well, they are portraiture in a way. There's a whole series of sock monkeys doing unusual things.
Which she does have on her couch, I believe.
Yes.
Portraits of her own sock monkeys. Yeah.
Yeah. Sock monkeys and donuts. Donuts play a role. Dentures are also highlighted in some of Stacy's work. I mean, you can see where this is going.
This is a family show. Mom.
Yeah. and Victoria Carlson is in this show as well. She is a Santa Fe artist and shows at Parks in Towson. Was one of six or seven artists in a show at the beginning of the year at the Museum of Fine Arts here. And Victoria is now exploring the idea of power in our culture, power and disaster. And she decided sort of that the greatest signifiers of power in our culture were bodybuilders, babies, and brides, which is nicely alliterative as well, bodybuilders, babies, and brides. And so she has posed these sometimes babies who are bodybuilders wearing bride's gowns. Bride's gowns? Did I say
that? I mean, it is some
bridal
very
gowns
weird
against national work. Natural disasters. You know, Mount St. Helens is erupting in the background. Yeah. That kind of stuff. You know, yeah. You know,
I mean, it's disturbing. It's disturbing in a world where nothing is disturbing anymore.
That's true. And well, and Susan Herdman's work is disturbing in an entirely different way. Susan also doesn't show in a gallery here right now, I don't believe. Susan makes, she has this project called The American Teenager?
Adolescent.
American Adolescent. Yeah. She's been working on for a long time, where she photographs adolescents and asks them to write about their lives and then incorporates these photographs and these little essays into sculptural, three-dimensional artworks that she makes. And, you know, there is no more disenfranchised group of people in the country than the adolescent. They're, you know, they're ignored, we hate them, they scare us, all those kind of things.
Right.
And most of these kids that she features are very messed up kids, or at least they were at the time she, you know, interviewed them for these artworks. And it's really an eye-opener. It's very much documentary work, but very much an eye-opener, too, as to what's going on in the mind of the adolescent today, which is a far cry from what Mary and I were worried about. And Beverly, too,
and
but
myself.
You're a little bit younger, so I'm not including you in this.
And Kim Russo's work is terrific. She's a very good artist.
Oh, yes. Kim had a great show at CCA this year, and she was also the woman artist selected as the lesbian artist for Gay Pride this year in Santa Fe. So she had an exhibit for that. And And Kim also, like Victoria, works in watercolor and graphite, but their work couldn't be more different visually. Kim's also been kind of doing disaster work lately,
yeah.
And she likes to do a lot of social criticism. You know, she depicts animals against industrial settings and all kinds of things that are rather difficult to describe, but a whole lot of fun.
So all of this is happening at Art Santa Fe, which is a big, huge, giant art fair.
Yeah.
That's right.
Art Santa Fe is the baby of Charlotte Jackson, the owner of Charlotte Jackson Fine Art, and she started it the first year of Site Santa Fe to coincide with Site Santa Fe as an international art fair, the kind that, you know, are all over the country and all over the world. And so in the beginning, it was every other year. And this year, for the first time, Art Santa Fe is becoming an annual show. So it will happen every summer. It's at El Museo Cultural. It's because there is no convention center yet.
Right. Yeah, you don't want to do it on a mound of dirt.
Right. But there are like 59 galleries from all over the world. There are galleries from China, from Thailand, from India, all over Latin America, plus New York galleries, Marlboro, some of the really big name galleries are coming this year. And it's fun because
it's amazing it's happening the same weekend as the folk art market.
Right. And that's good and bad. I mean, maybe if people are out looking at art at one or the other, they'll make the other party. But on the other hand, some of these people who like folk art might not necessarily be the same audience.
Yeah, but they very well might. I mean, I think many of our listeners would be very interested in going to both events. And the opening night of Art Santa Fe is tomorrow, Thursday, the 10th of July, from 5 to 8 in the evening. And then the fair hours are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Let's see, starting at 11 o'clock and going till either 7 on Friday or 6 on Saturday and Sunday. For more information, artsantafe.com. Hollis Walker is the curator of the Furies. You want to say one more thing?
I have one more thing I wanted to say that we entirely forgot to mention. That is our sponsor for our booth at Art Santa Fe is the Center for Contemporary Art. And Cindy Kahn, the visual director over there, visual arts director, liked our idea and took it forward for us. And so we're really proud to be representing CCA.
Well, that is wonderful. And so Hollis Walker is the Furious curator? Curator of the Furies?
Yes, and there are two other artists that are going to be in the show just because we didn't get to talk about them. Shirley Klinghoffer and who was the other one I
missed? Sarah Hutt.
Oh, Sarah Hutt. Yeah, Sarah Hutt's in from Boston for this show. So,
And Mary Bennett and Beverly Ash are in the show, and wonderful. We're so delighted. And there's a postcard that you have that shows the location of your little booth, and there's a gazillion booths in this thing. So make your time, ladies and gentlemen, over the weekend to check it out. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Wendy Kiefover-Ring. She is the Carnivore Protection Director with Wild Earth Guardians. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So, in June of this year, a cougar killed a person in New Mexico. Does that happen often?
No, it's very infrequent. In fact, this is the second fatality in New Mexico by a cougar since 1890. So mountain lion attacks or cougar attacks are very infrequent, and fatal attacks are especially infrequent. There's only been 18 in the U.S. since 1890.
And so the death that happened, which was very shocking to everybody, what happened? I mean, what was the story? Is it something that could have been prevented, or is it just a freak of nature?
It seems like it could have been prevented. I just read the newspaper accounts, and it appears that the man was regularly bathing and showering outside, you know, probably at dawn and dusk when cougars are most active. And, you know, when you live or recreate in cougar country, you want to take some common sense precautions. And avoiding dawn and dusk by yourself is one of the most prominent ones. So if you're outside, you should be with a group of people. And it seemed like, you know, he was probably doing that on a daily basis, and the mountain lion probably learned his behavior.
Now, do cougars normally prey on human beings?
No. In fact, Dr. Ken Logan, who did a 10-year research project there in New Mexico, he and his wife Linda Sweener did another research project in California, and they looked specifically at the behavior of cougars in relation to humans, and they had some radio-collared cats, and they determined that cats pretty much avoided humans during the time when humans are active. And so, you know, if they wanted to kill and eat us, they could. I mean, they're an ambush predator. They're very capable of taking down, you know, large adult elk even. But they don't view us as prey, I think, you know, because the mothers, when they teach the kittens how to hunt, you know, they have a certain profile for the kind of thing that they want to prey on. And typically it's wildlife like deer or maybe even rabbits or things like that.
What about livestock?
On occasion, mountain lions will take livestock. I've looked at data from the National Agricultural Statistics Service, which is a part of the USDA, for the whole U.S., and I haven't looked at it specifically for New Mexico, but essentially, of, you know, the 104.5 million cattle produced in the U.S., less than 1%, like 0.18% of cattle are actually killed by all predators. And for sheep, the total sheep production, 7 million, like 3% of the total sheep production are killed by all predators. And the most common predators to take livestock are coyotes first, and secondarily domestic dogs, if you can believe that. And
really?
Mountain lions are way down on the list, yeah.
So coyotes and dogs are way above. Now, when we talk about mountain lions, are mountain lions and cougars the same thing?
Yeah. Mountain lions and cougars and pumas and painters and panthers and catamounts are all the same thing. And the reason they have so many names is they were the most widespread mammal in North and South America. And they came into contact with so many different cultures. So they have something like 40 different names in English. But their Latin name is Puma Concolor, which means cat of the same color. And Puma actually comes from the Inca, and it means powerful animal.
We're talking to Wendy Kiefover-Ring with Wild Earth Guardians. Now, is there cougar hunting in New Mexico?
Yeah, there's cougar hunting basically all across the West and some parts of the Midwest, except for in California, where sport hunting is not allowed.
And what is the nature of, I mean, I don't even know people who do cougar hunting. You think of people going out and hunting deer and elk and things like that.
Right. Well, it's done quite differently. You typically, you know, a cougar hunter will hire a guide, and they have to have specially trained dogs, and the dogs wear radio collars. And what they do is they set out, they look for a track in snow or mud or something, and they'll find a track, and then they'll set the dogs on the track. And then the dogs will follow the track, and they'll bay the cougar up into a tree or a cliff or something. And then the guide will bring the hunter to where the cougar is, and they'll shoot it. So that's how it's done. It's not like deer hunting where you wear camouflage and you stalk around yourself. It's very high tech. There's a lot of technology involved, ATVs and radios and radio collared dogs and things like that.
Now, are cougars an endangered species in the state of New Mexico?
No, not at all. They barely have any protections in the state of New Mexico, and I'm very concerned. I've just looked at some of the data from over the last 10 years, and I'm concerned about not only the amount of hunting, but sort of the lack of regulation that goes on. Essentially, what you have is a hunting season. And it's a reasonable hunting season, but some parts of the state it's year round, and the bag limits are two in a great deal of the state. So New Mexico has kind of something unique that other states don't, where they have, for example, on private lands in bighorn sheep areas, the hunting is year round, and then the bag limit is two, which means one hunter can get two cats per year in these bighorn sheep areas. And I looked at the map that the New Mexico Game and Fish puts out and looked at where these bighorn sheep areas are, and it's literally a third of the state. So it's pretty liberal hunting in the state. And the thing that we're most concerned about is the amount of hunting on female, adult females, because that is the most important demographic of the population. In order to conserve a population, you need to ensure that you have lots of breeding females. But in New Mexico, we're seeing over the last 9 years, 42% of the hunter kill is comprised of females. Now, some of those females may be subadults. They may not be breeding females, because a female doesn't start to breed until she's like, you know, 27, 29 months old. So if you kill a mother cat, you know, she likely is raising kittens, and then you end up orphaning the kittens, and then you end up having population implications when you're removing the breeding females from the population. And so what we've done here in Colorado is instituted mandatory hunter education, and we're hoping that we can get New Mexico Game and Fish to sort of adopt this program too. And it's an online program. It's super slick. And what it does is it teaches hunters how to tell the difference between males and females. And there's a couple of really easy things that you can do before you even put the dogs on the ground. You measure the width of the track of the cat. And if it's 3.5 inches or lower, it's probably a female or a young cat. And if it's 5 inches, the width or greater, then you've got an adult tom. And then you can measure the stride length. And then there's ways, once you've got the cat bait up in the tree, you can look. You know, it's once you've been trained, but you can distinguish the sexual organs. They're not obvious like in other animals. They're kind of it's basically a spot on the rear end of the male cat that where the penis sheath and the scrotum are, and that's how you distinguish. It's not super obvious, but someone that's been trained can figure that out.
And so you've got that program in Colorado, and is it working? Are there fewer female cougars killed there?
Yes, absolutely. It is working. I haven't seen the data from last year, but before the Wildlife Commission here adopted that, they asked guides and hunters to do it voluntarily, and it was already having an effect. And just educating people about the importance of females in the population, and just educating them how to distinguish between the two sexes, it's made a huge difference. So it's been really great, and we hope we can bring that down there, because that's probably the single most important thing we can do to maintain the sustainability of New Mexico's cougar population, is to protect the adult females and their kittens.
So there's not an endangered species protection. In your view, are they endangered? I mean, are the population numbers shrinking?
Well, we don't know what the population is, because they're very cryptic. They're very hard to see. They're very hard to study. So we don't have an idea numerically how many there are. But we, there's been a 10-year study in the San Andreas Mountains, and that got a glimpse of it captured a glimpse of what the population in New Mexico could be. And then 2 years ago, University of New Mexico, Kurt Menke, did a GIS mapping project. So he looked at, how much prey is out there, what kind of terrain is it, good ambush cover for cats and things like that, and determined that in New Mexico you probably have on order, 1,300 adults. And then looking at the Logan study, if you have 1,300 adults, you probably have 130 subadults, and you probably have in the neighborhood of 500 kittens. So probably New Mexico has on order of 2,000 cougars in the whole state. So it's not a big number. In Colorado, for example, our state estimates we probably have 3,500 to 5,000 cats. So it's all about how much prey is available and things like that, how much habitat.
What is their role in the ecosystem?
Oh, they're super important, especially in desert ecosystems. You know, if you large carnivores, mountain lions, coyotes, wolves, they all have an important role to play. And there's a really cool study that looked at cougars in Zion National Park, where they were present and where they were absent. And where cougars were absent, you had too many deer, and the deer were overeating the willows and the aspens and the cattails and things like that, and over-browsing, and it resulted in less biological diversity. There were less kinds of plants, and there were less kinds of animals, like amphibians and things like that. And the amazing thing was the stream channel morphology changed. So where cougars were present, we had narrower streams, which means the water's colder. It's probably more beneficial to native fish. So it's they have huge effects in their ecosystem. So indirectly, by preying on deer, you increase the biological diversity in the area when you have cougars present. So they're just amazing.
Some people make the argument that if you have fewer cougars, then you have more deer available for human beings to hunt.
Yeah, and that seems to be kind of the motivation for New Mexico Game and Fish for how they're setting quotas and bag limits. In fact, for this year, they want to increase the bag limit in one game unit because it's an important deer hunting area. And I think that's a bit short-sighted. But here's the other thing. Mountain lions don't regulate the population size of the deer. The deer, they modulate it. So if you don't have sufficient deer, you're not going to have enough mountain lions in an area, enough cougars in an area. So, you know, if there's a lot of complicating factors that set the population size of a deer. So it can be, you know, how much browse is there available for them. If you've had a lot of drought, you're not going to have a lot of browse, and so their populations are going to go down. Is there livestock-borne diseases, which is really common among native ungulates, especially for desert bighorn and things like that. Livestock can produce disease that native ungulates can get, or, you know, livestock can actually compete with native ungulates for food competition. So it's all very complicated, and it's not a simple system.
We're talking to Wendy Kiefover-Ring with Wild Earth Guardians about the destiny of the cougar here in the state of New Mexico. You were talking about the bighorn sheep a moment ago. What is the role of bighorn sheep in the ecosystem in relationship to cougars?
Well, you know, some of the studies that I've read that they say that cougars are not necessarily a very important predator of bighorn sheep, and generally if there is predation on bighorn sheep herds, it's usually one individual that's learned to specialize on them. They're typically, they prefer mule deer in New Mexico as their main form of prey.
So individual cougars develop specialties?
Yes, exactly. And here's the other thing. If you've got a lot of fire suppression, which we've had all over the West, what you end up with is a lot of pinyon juniper and a lot of ambush cover for cougars. So if you're suppressing fire, then you've got more ambush cover, then you have more opportunities for cougars to take bighorn sheep. So again, things are just not very simplistic. There's all these things that play a role in population sizes of wild animals.
So what is the nature of the so-called preventive cougar program in New Mexico?
Well, my understanding is New Mexico Game and Fish, they pay a game cash fund, so basically revenue from anglers and hunters to a trapper. My understanding is it's $42,000 a year to trap 20 cougars in three game management units in the southern part of the state to benefit a handful of livestock growers. And so one of the things that we're asking the Game Commission this year is to end that program. We don't think it's a good use of funds, number one. We think that livestock growers should use a whole host of non-lethal controls, which actually work better in the long run, such as putting your livestock in barns at night and things like that, or, you know, having guard animals or having barriers like fences. There's a whole host of non-lethal
controls. Or dogs.
Yeah, dogs or llamas, or there's actually mixing cattle with sheep works to prevent, I don't think, probably not for cougars as much as coyotes or other predators. But, there's a whole host of literature out there about non-lethal controls. And we think that's a better use of how to, you know, protect livestock rather than killing cougars. You know, because if you keep killing cougars like that, you create a population sink. You remove animals from, you know, sort of the whole population, and that creates the stress on the population. And by constantly killing in an area like that, what you're doing is actually inviting in lots of young cougars because you've created a space, a territory that's available for a cougar. And ironically, you know, by killing cougars, you end up with younger animals. Those are the animals that are more likely to take livestock. So it's better to manage for a stable, more adult population to prevent conflicts with not only with people but also with livestock.
And, I mean, I think
and
it's
the
really...
other thing is, you know, this $42,000, wouldn't it be better spent if, you know, New Mexico Game and Fish were using that to do coexistence education, you know, about mountain lions and black bears and things like that? How can we coexist with large native carnivores rather than spending it to benefit one trapper and a handful of livestock growers? Let's benefit the whole state.
It's, I mean, I think it's an important point that you were making a moment ago about cougar populations like human populations. There's a balance of old and mature and younger beings, and those societies have a coherence, which if you start disrupting it, has a lot of consequences.
Right, exactly. And so with, you know, it's... You want to have adults in a population to maintain stability, whether it's humans or whether it's cougars. And, you know, the thing about cougars is they're very territorial. And, you know, the only time they'll come together is if a female is an estrus, and then they'll breed. And then the male goes away, and she spends her whole life raising kittens. So she'll spend about 24 months raising kittens. And then once they emancipate, then she'll have the next set of kittens. And so when those kittens emancipate, they need to emigrate and they need to find their own territory. And most of the time when that happens, they get into, you know, especially for males because they have to migrate further, they get into conflicts with other adult males. There's a lot of mortality naturally in cougar populations because of what's called interspecific strife, so cats fighting each other to the death over territories. Or, you know, while they're migrating, they may get hit by cars or other things. So, you know, habitat fragmentation and roads can really affect a cougar population, too.
What you're talking about is stuff that most of us don't have any idea about, like the dynamics of cougar societies or the, you know, the effect of species like cougars on the depth of streams and the, you know, the growth of willows and things like that. I mean, it's stuff that is... the work of wildlife scientists, presumably the people in the government commissions that are, you know, who have to deal with these with regulating cougars, with regulating wildlife, are savvy about this. But what is the dynamic between, let's say, you at Wild Earth Guardians and the government agencies that regulate things like hunting and hunter education with cougars?
Well, you know, this will be the second time I've come to New Mexico to kind of organize people and talk to people about cougars, and we're going to be meeting with a couple of the game commissioners while I'm down there. But I've been doing this stuff for, 10 years, and, you know, up here in Colorado, we've really worked with our Colorado Division of Wildlife and with the Wildlife Commission to get significant reforms. For our mountain lion population, we got the hunting quota reduced to an amount that is sustainable, that the scientists are comfortable with, you know, that we've got this mandatory hunter education program that promotes protecting females and their dependent kittens. And now we've got a 10-year study on our Uncompahgre Plateau to look at the effects of hunting on a population. We've got a study on the Front Range looking at human and mountain lion interactions and things like that. So when you come in and start doing this stuff, you're not very popular with the state game agency or with the commission. But I think, you know, we've always tried to do kind of a science-based, you know, let's look at this. How can we get management that's sustainable and makes sense for the long term? And I think, you know, being persistent has actually paid off for us in the long term. And I hope that we can sort of bring that to New Mexico.
What is the role of the public in all of this?
Well, there's an opportunity to comment right now, actually, before the New Mexico Game Commission, and we just actually put out an action alert. So people can go to our website, which is wildearthguardians.org, and find the action alert for the New Mexico Cougar Management. So in New Mexico, when the Game Commission sets regulations, which they'll come up with a final decision this October. That decision will be in place for 2009 and 2010. So it's really important that people do weigh in. And the other thing that we're doing, Mary Charlotte, is I'm actually coming down and doing a series of talks in New Mexico, and I'll be in Santa Fe on July 16th to do a talk at the public library.
And what time is that?
That's at 7 o'clock.
And Wendy Kiefover-Ring is the Carnivore Protection Director of Wild Earth Guardians, and as said, she will be in Santa Fe on July 16th at the Santa Fe Public Library. And we thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, Mary Charlotte. Really appreciate it.
Not at all. We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Sean Diani and Vince Kadlebeck of the Meow Wolf Gallery. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey.
And you're going to be having an opening, which is tomorrow, Thursday, the 10th of July, from 7 to 10 in the evening. And you'll be open for the remainder of July. And Meow Wolf Gallery is on 2nd Street, right near the corner of Cerrillos Road.
Right.
Now, this is a show called Everybody Only.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
Well, we just came off of a big collaborative show called Biome Neuro Norb that just went down in mid-June. And we really
That was phenomenal.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Yeah, it was a lot of work. It was like, we were just amazed by how much fun it was. There I am. How much fun it was to actually put up that show, and how much fun people had going to the show. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do, is just like, you know, do fun art that then, you know, exudes that sort of energy, so that when people go, it actually changes their experience of what, like, an art experience is. And that's the whole point of Meow Wolf, you know, I think. And so after that show, we basically had the idea, you know, that we wanted to do something a little bit more low-key. We wanted to transform the space real quickly and give an opportunity to invite more people in, and to just, you know, just contact other artists that are out there, of any age, of, you know, of any medium, of any style, and anyone who's looking for, you know, a space to show. And so we just basically put out a call for artists on Craigslist and on MySpace. And
Does that work?
I got about 10 to 15 responses through Craigslist, and got another like 6 or 8 responses through MySpace.
Interesting. So, I mean, how does that compare to like putting an ad in the paper?
I've never done the paper. I've never tried doing the paper. I mean, it's like, it's a little bit more, it's just like a little too of process and money. You know, it's like, it's an extra $20 and an extra phone call that I really don't have to do on MySpace or Craigslist. So it's
right.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, the more you can actually live your life sitting on one chair,
right,
the better.
Right. Yeah. Totally. So yeah, we got a really good response from that. And so this show, Everybody Only, is just kind of like this open, unjudged, you know, just anybody can put in anything that they want, and we will fill the space as much as we possibly can.
Now, the thing about Biome Neuro Norb was it was this sprawling, just you couldn't even take it all in, just massive amounts of stuff everywhere you looked. There was no blank space on the floor, walls, or ceiling. Are you expecting this to be a similar thing?
I think that was part of the hope, that we would get so much work that we would be able to kind of cram the space with all of this work. And it wasn't juried at all, you know, it's not like we're, you know, not accepting people to come in and show their work. We want as many people to come in as possible. And we were talking a little bit before the show about whether we're a collective or not. And
right.
I think, you know, we are a collective in some ways, but we want to be as open as possible to other people, not only coming in and looking at work and enjoying art and even music, hopefully, in the future, but also displaying stuff and being creative and having a space and an outlet for expression, basically.
Now, you said anybody of all ages are invited. It tends to be sort of a younger person scene over there so far.
So far, yeah, so far. And that's just because the people, you know, who have started it, and just like the associations that we have, are all in a younger area. And I mean, it's also an important, I mean, we feel like the 20-something demographic and the youth demographic, younger than 20, you know, are the most forgotten about, or not forgotten about. It's the place, it's, you know, it's the demographic that doesn't have nearly as many venues to show in. So I mean, that was our initial our initial energy. Plus, that's just like, again, the fun energy, the youthful energy. We want to have that fun youthful energy, but we think that fun youthful energy is something that is not age specific.
Right.
You know, that can exude no matter, you know, what age. And actually, for this show, we have a good amount of work from people you know, over the age of 30. And actually, the majority of the work is from people, you know, over the age of 30.
So it's kind of catching on.
Yeah, yeah, and people have enjoyed it. I mean, it's really, you know, it's totally do-it-yourself. We have no idea what we're doing. People are bringing in their art, and I, you know, just writing down names and prices on paper, and I'm just trying to organize it all. And the whole process of trying to put together an actual, real, you know, real, quote-unquote, legit, quote-unquote, gallery show has been a really good experience to just kind of see how how that coordination works.
Now, you are at this wonderful space on Second Street, but you're going to be moving out of there and, in fact, are looking for a new space.
Yeah, yeah.
What, tell us about that.
Well, we're looking for a new space, and we're kind of looking around the Siler Road area right now because we're thinking
there's nowhere else.
There's really nowhere else to play. Basically, we want to have music. We want to have a space that can accommodate music, shows, and art. And
it's amazing. It's like Biome Near North, we worked so hard on and put so much energy in, but the amount of people we got on a given night was, you know, 20, 50. You know, opening night, we got 100. We do a music show. One night, we have 100 kids, 150 kids who are showing up for music. Like, the amount, it's like, you know, it's all, and it's all based on the creation of culture. And, like, the amount of culture that occurs, the amount of culture that is created in one night of music is just
it's
phenomenal.
Intense. It's intense and concentrated.
Yeah.
And it's nice either way, too. I mean, I think it's nice to have a sort of prolonged experience of something where people, and for us, the people who kind of worked on the show and were so intimately involved, it changed for the 5 weeks that it was open, and it was incredible. Every weekend was different. Every night was different. There were different people coming in and a different atmosphere in there, and that was really nice. But I think the intensity of sort of energy that's concentrated in a music show is really great, and it's something that's kind of needed in this town as much as possible, in any town.
So basically, we want to do both. We want to have a space large enough in the Siler Road area, because that's really the only area that we can have music shows. So like a warehouse space that's large enough so that we can have the art installation, full environment art installation on like one side of it, and then a good 1,000 square feet dedicated to a music.
Dancing music on the other side.
Yeah.
And so of all types, too.
If somebody out there who's listening knows of something or wants to contact you, how should they do so?
Please, please, please. That'd be great. You can call me. I'm Vince. And you can call me at my cell phone, which is 505-603-9176.
And that's Vince Cadlebeck, 603-9176. And meanwhile, the opening of Everybody Only is from 7 to 10 o'clock at the Meow Wolf Gallery in its current incarnation at 1403 Second Street, right here in Santa Fe. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Vince Cadlebeck and Sean Diani. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features some old-time lions and some young tigers. All right. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.